Hello, this is MR Radio. I'm GW. We've got a full house today. Daniel is here online. Kimiko is here online. And our guest today, who is Bill Bailey, who's a long-time political commentator on the British scene. Not sure whether he describes himself as a nationalist these days. We'll find out about that. But Bill is known by a lot of people for sending them on the first of every month through their email, European Outlook, which is a newsletter which covers quite wide-ranging and interesting commentary on general affairs and on those subjects in particular, of course, which are most of interest to nationalist thinkers. So welcome, Bill. Nice to have you along.
Hi.
Okay, we'd like to cover a few subjects with you, and the first one that we'd like to talk about is your own development as a political animal. And this is going back quite a long time. This is going back into the 1950s and 60s, yes?
Well, I came across a meeting of the National Labour Party, which was John Bean and John Tyndall, in, I think it was 1959. I would have only been 14 or 15 years old then. I was born in 1945. Mm-hmm. I was cycling around with a friend of mine, and we was at Trafalgar Square, and we came across this meeting. And they had a banner up saying, "Stop immigration." You know, this seems incredible. It was that way going. It was a problem then. Yeah. And I immediately related to it. And I wanted to join, but they wouldn't let me join. They said, "No, come back when you're a bit older."
Right.
So I eventually joined the League of Empire Loyalists, which was a kind of a high Tory pressure group, but they believed in a lot of things that they believed in. At that time, I was very much a British nationalist, I suppose, wanting to preserve what was left of the empire. Mm-hmm. Very much a child of the age. Of course, Things have moved on, and I've moved on with them.
Yes, naturally. And at that time, John Tyndall was already a significant political force. You met him, you met other quite interesting people. You were saying to us a little while ago that you almost met Enoch Powell.
I did. I bumped into him walking down Lombard Street, but it was hardly a meeting. I just congratulated him on his speech.
And other people who are major figures in this movement?
Oh, I know Colin Jordan and John Sindel, John Bean. Yeah.
Yes. Would you say that you've departed from the way that nationalist thought has developed from where these guys were in the late 50s and 60s and 70s?
I've certainly moved in a different direction to John Sindel and his faction. Mm. But I very much followed the path of Oswald Mosley, because he arrived at this European concept back in 1948 when he realised that the empire was finished. Oh. And in my opinion, the rest of the nationalist movement is marching down a cul-de-sac. I always put it that way.
Well, would you like to expand on that a little bit? I mean, if you're saying that the days of the nation state in Europe are finished.
Well, it's self-evident. It has happened. We're all in NATO. Okay, Britain's not in the Eurozone, but our economies are very much integrated.
Yeah, this idea of political
sovereignty is entirely bogus. We haven't been an independent nation in my lifetime.
No. Would you call yourself a regionalist?
Well, I've got no interest in destroying the individual character of countries and regions and nations. Indeed, it's important to keep them going. But it mustn't be the overriding thing. The overriding thing must be European civilization.
When people go to war, you know, the strict reason for that is love of their own people. Love of the civilization is at one remove, possibly even two removes. Actually, so I mean, you know, if you want to motivate people to stand up and defend and fight for something, you would expect to be able to do that most effectively if you're appealing to that which they love the most, and ordinarily, certainly, you know, there is a debate about this. I mean, if you talk to people in the mainstream, they will often refer to the threat from Islam and the clash of civilizations and this sort of thing, and they'll talk about Western civ, you know, as though it's the defining value. But psychologically, actually, it isn't. However, people do believe that So, to some extent, you are right in that, you know, there's a perception of special value attached to Western civilization, to scientific progress, and all of those things which divide the civilized world, as we would regard it, from the third.
Well, you know, some races have demonstrated that they're capable of maintaining a civilization, and some have not been so good at it.
Yes.
And we should only let into Europe those people that are going to be an asset to us.
So basically, that's the Northern Hemisphere races then?
Yeah. This business that's going on at the moment with the Syrian refugees, there's an element of unconscious racism at work here. Because the blacks who are turning up in Italy are not getting the same welcome as the relatively white Syrians are getting when they turn up in Europe. But when I was in South Africa, there were Syrians there and Lebanese, and they was classed as white. I believe that the Middle Eastern people are classed as white in the United States.
Yeah.
They're perceived to be white, and they will disappear in Germany and in Sweden. But the Senegalese and the Nigerians and the Jamaicans will never disappear.
I mean, the important thing with on the subject of race is to preserve your own kind, you know, and you lose your own kind with any foreign
people. Yeah, we've got what, five million Asians, 3 million blacks, 10,000 Syrians is not going to make any difference.
But if it's just the opening of the or turning of the key on the door, how long would it take the liberal classes to turn their attention to the Africans who are struggling to cross the Med from the south? Oh dear, look, war in Eritrea, you know, failing nation Somalia.
Yeah, so, sure, and I don't underrate how powerful the media is, but I still think that this unconscious racism I was talking about would play a part. People will never be as sympathetic to the blacks as they are to people who are perceived to be more or less the same as ourselves.
Okay.
Yes. Can I jump in with a question there?
Yes,
about,
please.
The comment on Syrians is, how do you disambiguate, I mean, if you're going to at all, how do you disambiguate between Syrians and I suppose Iraqis as well, who may be non-Muslim and fleeing from ISIL persecution, for example, and Sunni Muslim Iraqis and Syrians who may be part of a deliberate strategy of attempting to undermine Europe? Because ISIL have already threatened that they would send 4,000 migrants that they would put among the refugees to form cells inside of Europe to carry out future attacks. So knowing that this could possibly be happening, what would your stance on the present situation be, Bill? Should like each person be screened as they're coming in, or should they just be a total lockdown on anyone coming in who is Muslim, for example?
Yeah, difficult one. I'm not sure that I know the answer. We've got security forces and security agencies, and they would just have to be on the job, I suppose.
But they don't.
Okay.
Succeed.
Oh, so you're not opposed to something like, say, the Snoopers Charter that Theresa May has been championing.
I'm afraid I'm not a great libertarian. Countries need laws. We need security services. We need governments to know what's going on.
Okay, I agree with you.
There's one thing that I'm curious about. You say that you were a great admirer of Oswald Mosley, and that seems to correspond with a certain amount of cooperation amongst European nations towards their interests, or at least cooperation with Germany. He certainly wanted cooperation between Germany and England. It seems to me that he was fairly racial, so I don't understand how you reconcile your skeptical attitude towards racialist positions with an admiration for Oswald Mosley.
I think I've read everything that Mosley ever wrote, and he doesn't strike me as being a racist at all. He was opposed to coloured immigration into the United Kingdom.
Well, and wasn't he deeply committed to the preservation of the native British folk?
Yeah.
That's pretty racial to me.
Okay. Not compared with the likes of Arnold Leese and Colin Jordan and John Tyndall,
uh-huh,
who, you know, they kept subdividing the white race into ever smaller groups and spending days arguing whether an individual was Nordic or East Baltic. You know, involved in any of that, this sort of scientific or biological races.
I've taken to calling people who get carried away with that sort of minutiae as right-wingers.
Yeah.
And people who take a broad view of Europeans as having valid ethno-nationalist concerns, which are not necessarily in conflict, that would seem to correspond with the way you're looking at things.
Yeah.
But it almost seems to me that you're reacting to a reaction. These guys like Tyndall and such were overreacting in one way, and you might be kind of reacting in another. I don't get the sympathy, for example, for blacks under these circumstances. I can't relate to it when I look at their population explosion, and I don't see them being harmless to England at all. I just have to look at the riots, at the kind of miscegenation.
No, I'm not advocating letting non-Europeans in large numbers into Britain at all. I never have. I'm just saying that we've got to look at reality. We have got millions and millions of blacks and Asians here.
Thing is,
a few thousand Syrians is not going to make any difference.
Let's wind back a bit into what we were talking about before, which is the long-distant past and the beginning of a political effort to generate a non-white aspect to the makeup of this country. I remember when I was a very small child, I'm a little younger than you, I was born in 51. My mum and dad would take myself and my sister up the A23. We lived in South London on the outskirts of the city. And we'd go up the A1 to visit grandparents, all four of whom were from North Bucks, so what is now Milton Keynes. And we'd spend the day up there, and on the way back down again into the Brixton area. And on a fine evening, you would see all of these blacks, which there was, you know, a reasonable number in those days, and they would be very, very finely and colourfully regaled, and you know, they would be sitting on the steps of these old houses. You usually had five or six steps going up to the front door and a little cellar maybe underneath, and they looked very picturesque. And looking at them, you'd have to say, and I remember this, I would have been no more than about 4 or 5 years old. You'd have to say, well, you know, they have a certain sort of zoological interest. They look entirely harmless. But of course, that wasn't the end of the story. That was the beginning of the story. And today we have a black population, which is probably 3 million or more. And it's not going to stop there. It's going to carry on growing. For structural reasons, and it has a completely different impact for us than the one which, you know, it seemed to have in those heady, airy times of yore. Now we've got this situation where the Syrian migrants, and migrants generally, I have to say that, they're all now not really migrants at all, but refugees, are being sainted in the sort of classical Camp of the Saints style. You know, they're being sainted by the media, and we're being maneuvered into a position where we have to celebrate diversity. So, you know, while all of this is going on, there is not simply, as the Hungarian Prime Minister has now twice pointed out, there's not simply these groups that are coming in at the moment. There is behind them 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 million, endless number of others, all of whom would very much like to set up home and do very nicely in Northern Europe. Now, if you don't want that, you have to say, I don't want the first through the door. I'm not going to say, well, you know, what difference is it going to make if we've got 10,000 or 100,000? Because that soon turns into millions. At the moment, Europeans have a fertility of 1.5. We've got Kumiko with us in Japan. I think it's no better in Japan, is it?
Yes.
What's the fertility rate in Japan, Kumiko?
Just off the top of my head, I think it's something like 1.2.
1.2. That's not, that's the same as Italy. It's the lowest in the world, I believe. So that's a pretty serious situation. And at 1.5, quite without the losses that you get to race mixing and to emigration, flight abroad, at 1.5 you halve your number every three generations, and a generation is 20 to 25 years. So, you know, over, say, 70 years, your population is going to come down by half anyway.
Yes,
you just can't sit there saying, oh, well, you know, 10,000, no problem, because that's not where it stops. Where it stops is your own minoritization and the building up of vast communities, many of which are Muslim, who do not view you as you want them to, and are not to be viewed themselves as those picturesque West Indians, you know, smiling and joking and taking their ease on the front steps in the evening sunshine of 1957 or something. It's totally different. And the only way you protect yourself is right at the beginning when you say, no, door is shut. You have to say that. And if you're not asked and your political class decides to coerce you into this risky future and doesn't bother to seek your consent, well, then you have to say you have not got legitimization for what you've done. And that frees us at any time of our choosing to make whatever changes we need to secure our existence. Now, this is a racial argument. Can you really say you disagree with it?
No, not at all. And I've never said that I wanted non-Europeans in large numbers to come to the UK or anywhere in Europe. I don't. I would shut the door, absolutely. All right. I'm saying is, let's not overreact to this latest refugee thing. There are planes landing at Heathrow and in Stockholm, Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Every day of the week full of immigrants.
Yes, this is true.
But when you see a picture of the poor little boy on a beach, or you see pictures of people in overcrowded boats, it looks very dramatic and it captures your attention.
Mm.
But immigration is happening all the time, and nobody takes any notice of it.
Mm. Mm. Well, we do.
I do, yeah. There's a couple things that seem really interesting to me in interface with Bill. One seems to be maybe a problematic area that I think that Kumiko would be particularly good in addressing, that of ethnic genetic interests and how much impact, for example, that Africans can have genetically, even just almost by incidental contact. But on the positive side, what's really interesting to me, and how why I was eager for this conversation, is that Bill seems to be open to ways of organizing and perhaps wresting something like the European Union structure to our interests, which is something that I think that Kumiko has in mind as well. I wouldn't have even aspired to that, but Kumiko seems to think that it might be possible and it might be a way to go. And interestingly, Bill seems to think that as well. And it's an unusual position for, because almost in the white nationalist world, almost everybody is against the European Union. So it is interesting.
Well, you know, in the financial crisis, when the financial crisis first started out, many countries in Asia essentially doubled down their bet on European success. Because, you know, from the Asian perspective, there is a future with Europe that cannot be avoided. And so we're kind of reliant on this idea that Europeans will be able to come together, and they'll be able to accomplish tasks together, and they'll be able to get along and carry out the EU 2020 targets and, of course, defend their borders from various different kinds of threats.
If it could work, like, that'd instance, be ideal.
Like, for instance, let's take the issue of Greece. Bill Bailey said earlier that he's not in with people who measure heads and so on. And of course, you know, the people who measure heads would often say, oh, you know, you don't count the Greeks because, you know, the Greeks are not quite as white as people would want them to be, and so on and so forth. I don't know where they get these ideas from. So obviously it's very good to see that Bill Bailey obviously counts Greece as being, you know, a true part of Europe. Particularly in the case of this crisis where Greece was having and continues to have these fiscal borrowing problems. If Greece were to leave Europe, as many of these people who describe themselves as Nordicists want, it would result in, like, for instance, Russia establishing a closer relationship in the Mediterranean. Because what is Greece? Greece is a gateway into the Mediterranean. It's also a key NATO outpost in the Balkans. So people can't just say, oh, well, you know, Greece doesn't count as a real place anymore and just, you know, leave it alone. No.
Well, where it becomes infuriating to me is when you have these people saying, oh, Greece, they're not acceptable as Europeans, but Africans, that's no problem. These are the people that blow my mind.
Well, of course, I don't know of anyone who's saying that, of course. But I mean,
there are people who say that.
But I mean, asking Greece also to back this Western pipeline that's supposed to be in the works, that is allegedly going to connect Europe to Azerbaijan for natural gas as well. So that's another part of diversifying away from Russian energy. So when people say these bad and negative things about Greece and so on and so forth, these things also have security ramifications if they were to actually enact them. So you have to keep all these things in mind as well. So I do see Europe as a positive structure because of the fact that it's the first time, I think, possibly one of the first times in history that Europeans have been able to come together and not fight each other. Because usually history is in the European continent is replete with Europeans fighting each other. Mm. And this time around, they're actually, they seem to be not doing it so much this time around.
Can you talk a little bit about ethnic genetic interests, about the impact of sub-Saharan Africans after you finish that?
I will. There's also obviously 5 targets for the EU in 2020, which I would like to ask Bill Bailey if he agrees. But the 5 targets are, they would like 75% of 20 to 64-year-olds to be employed. They would like 3% of EU's GDP to be invested in R&D. They want to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 20% or even 30%. They want 20% of the energy to come from renewables. They want 20% increase in energy efficiency. They want reduction in the rate of early school leavers to be below 10%. And they want at least 40% of 30 to 44-year-olds to have completed third-level education. And for fighting poverty and social exclusion, they want at least 20 million fewer people in or at risk of poverty and social exclusion. And those are the 5 targets for the EU in 2020 that they would like to carry out. Do you agree that those are good targets?
I think they're excellent targets.
Okay, that's good and heartening to hear. I've got also a follow-up to that as well. Do you also then agree that you'd need for common capital markets? For instance, you have 28 different capital markets, 28 different sets of interest rates you'd end up with if you were to break up the European Union and so on. And so obviously you want these things to be put together. A common energy policy as well. Having a common energy policy saves you money. I'm assuming you agree on that as well.
I would like to see as much integration as possible at all levels.
Okay. And so then you also agree with integrated European defence also?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And of course, you know...
Of course. Although nobody will tell us about it, we've got that already. The basis of our defence policy is the Anglo-French Naval Agreement of 2010, which nobody ever refers to, but is the whole basis of our defence strategy.
Yes, very well said. And so I'm assuming you also see the EU CSDP is complementary to NATO and that these things are functioning together, even though they don't come out in overtly.
Yeah, you know, Daniel was talking about Corbyn and these revolutionary ideas. You know, we set up a national investment bank and UKIP have got some revolutionary ideas about what they want to do. But people will not go for these extremist positions. The reality is NATO exists, the European Union exists. We have got to use these institutions or steer them around to our advantage. It's no good talking about just destroying things. You can't destroy Congress because you don't like it. You can't destroy the Westminster Parliament because you don't like it. We've got to use these things to our own advantage.
Okay, that's an optimistic view, and I can agree that that's a worthy objective. What I'm concerned about that ethnic I'm concerned that ethnic genetic interests are not being taken seriously. The impact foreign genetics on native populations in Europe.
But that's something that needs to be in. If you're going to have a European Union, it has to be founded on an acceptance that European peoples have natural rights on their own soil. and difference is the nature of the union, not homogeneity.
I agree 100%, but it seems to be, maybe there's not enough understanding of Saltaraska EGI, the impact of foreign peoples. What are the calculations, Kumiko, on you know, the equivalence of a dead child? And
I don't literally have it on the screen in front of me. I didn't think we were going to discuss that, but I'll just try to recall from my memory. Depending on the type of person who is being referred to, at least the type of population that is coming into your area, the genetic impact is different. And so, for example, Europeans moving into other European countries, they share more of your alleles than people moving from countries that share less of your alleles, and so the impact is more in that particular case.
In the later case?
Yeah, in the latter case. Yeah. And so, well, I mean, it sounds obvious, it's kind of like I'm repeating myself, but...
It's not well enough known.
I think that Harpenden and Cavalier-Schwarz had a...
Yes, that's right.
I don't know how much of it was actually... Cavalier-Schwarzer. I think most of it was Harpenden. But he came up with something like lost child equivalents.
Lost child surrogates.
Yeah, so Danish to a typical, any random Dane to any random English. The cost of a Danish man or woman being in England would have a certain value, and the cost of a Bantu would have another value.
And yes, I think with Danes...
And the difference between the two, it turned out to be absolutely vast. It's
yes,
huge.
I think from recollection, I think the Danish impact was something like 110, whereas the Bantu impact was 10, something 000. Like 11... No, it was more than the 10,000. It was 11,000 something,
wow,
800
yeah,
and something.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's a long time since I studied Salter that closely. This, you see, Bill, is what you would probably describe as head measuring, but it's science. And what you have got today is a very, very precise, genomically grounded modus for examining populations, human populations, and for determining the variation within and between them. And the thing is that these determinations interact with ethics. They're not ethics-free, because man makes choices in his life. And in consequence of that, an argument can be construed whereby preserving Frank Salter called the genetic interests, actually the word was around a long time before him, but anyway, genetic interests of your own people is the most evolutionary, adaptive choice to take. So this is a kind of an ethical argument about human evolution and about preservation of kind. It's not head measuring. We're not talking about Nazis over in Tibet, you know, with rulers and things looking at the people's skulls. It's not that sort of thing anymore.
Yeah, but are we not conflating two things here? I'm talking about European Union, the European peoples uniting as one empire, one bloc. And then there's a second problem. The second problem is that all European countries are now got large amounts of non-European immigrants. But that's a separate issue.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, but one issue was being dealt with in a way that seems to be level-headed and optimistic, and another seems to be head in the sand. I mean,
No. What I'm saying is,
if you say we can't get these blacks out, well, in a sense, we've got to start to play.
Yeah. But the only way that we can possibly do it is with a combined European effort.
I do agree with that.
If the United Kingdom, if there's some kind of national front government somehow came to power in the United Kingdom and tried to do any of these things, the United States would shut it down in an afternoon. We have not got the political, military, logistic, diplomatic clout to do these things.
No,
United
you are right,
Europe could have.
What you have to remember is that what has happened over the last 6 to 7 decades. Has run against the grain of human nature. And that is why it's had to be attended by various forms of coercion, including anti-racism and including legal constraints, of course, to our traditional freedoms of speech and association, and a political correctness in its widest interpretation, which is really just people like us call cultural Marxism and get told off for doing so by people on the left.
Yeah, I call it liberalism. You can call it Marxism. Well,
I don't think I would call it liberalism. I think liberalism is different. But anyway, by the by,
it is liberalism, and that's the prescription of the red left, the Marxist left to us is liberalism, and that's so I agree with Bill on that one.
If you look what happened to Rhodesia, Rhodesia was finished off not by the black guerrillas. The regime could fight them, but it was done economically. South Africa pulled the plug on Rhodesia.
Yes.
And then eventually, South Africa itself was destroyed by economic sanctions. Mm. The white regime. Yes.
Kumiko is
this
a big
economic
fan of
warfare is ever so powerful. Look what's happened to Iran. The Iranians have had to come to an accommodation and stop their nuclear program. It is very, very powerful. They're now ratcheting it up against Russia. American economic power is formidable. We would not last 5 minutes on our own if we had some kind of, as I say, some kind of National Front government came to power, which I think is impossible. But if it did happen, it would only last an afternoon.
There's also the issue that I wanted to mention of who supports and who opposes EU involvement, because particularly in the United Kingdom, it's often underestimated as to how large the support is in certain areas. For example, let's give you some stats here. 90% of financial services firms, 83% of manufacturers, and 92% of car manufacturers in the UK would like to stay in the European Union. So which party is going to basically say, get lost to 83% of manufacturers?
If you go to the Institute of Directors, what you would call big industry, the really big headline industries, and you ask them what they want, they'll be very clear about it. And, you will get that story. But if you go to small businesses, which employ far more people, you will get an entirely different story. The point at issue is that small businesses don't fund politics. Big businesses fund politics.
Well, if SMEs were able to get more credit from, say, European Union projects, for example, they might change their view on the issue as well. Because I think the European Union is not exceptional compared to the nation states, or at least that's the way that I've looked at it. Because, like, for instance, the British state during the first stages of the economic crisis didn't necessarily care too much about bailing out, quote unquote, small and medium enterprises. They were more interested in obviously bailing out the biggest things possible, right? Mm. The European Union, like that, behaved in much the same way. So fixing it on one level, you also would have a knock-on effect of fixing it on the other level as well.
Well, most politically aware directors of SMEs would say, well, hang on a minute, that is my money you're trying to give back to me. All the power resides in the hands of the banks and Dateline corporations. And politicians are all over Europe, the political class as a whole, because it's funded by these people, but governments are all in hoc to this, and they are obedient. They would come at it from that point of view. How to democratize it? That's the problem resolved.
You'd have to send the appropriate people, I think, to the European Parliament, and also you'd have to try to get a European Commission that doesn't bend the knee to the aforementioned financial powers who would love to keep giving money to themselves.
Yes.
So yeah, I can agree on that. I assume that Bill Bailey does as well, of course.
Well, I think that capitalism works.
Yeah.
It works in China, it works in Russia, it works in the EU, it works in the United States. The whole world is capitalist. If the UK withdrew from the European Union, it would not be one iota less capitalist.
No, but there's
so
a
I
difference
think the
between
the entire argument.
There's
is,
a difference between
is
capital
bogus.
And money power. You know, you've got to, it's not a bogus argument. We want to be free. We want to have free enterprise. We want to have to be able to sell our labour, we want to be able to employ, we want to be free to trade. But that's a different argument from saying, well, power is going to be monopolised in the cause of the ultra-rich and the ultra-powerful. which is what we're moving toward. You know, this isn't a
conspiracy. That's your perspective. Well, going back to the five objectives.
Yeah.
They seem to me to be very socially inclusive.
No, they're not. Actually, if you look at them, I mean, the global warming...
Well, you don't think it's a good idea to increase education and increase prosperity?
No. Global warming, no, I don't. I don't think it's as simple as that. I think you have to look at what arrives as politics and look at it and determine who actually benefits from it. Now, I mean, a good part of this is about 3% for objective for R&D. Is that taxes that are going to be spent on private companies R&D? Another one was greenhouse energy and energy concerns. Well, I mean, you know, this is just the wish list of big business. Big business loves this kind of bureaucratic solution. You've got to find a way of democratizing Europe if you want to have some kind of structure that operates between nations. You've got to find a way of democratizing it so that other interests do not impose their will. That's the point. Now, even the question of saying putting early school leavers, you know, you don't want to have any more early school leavers, folks, let's get the percentage down to this. Well, how can you do that whilst you're filling up your schools with non-white people, you know, whose native populations do not necessarily produce people who are going to want to hang around in education?
Yeah, it's a problem, yeah.
So, you know, there's something going on. Well, who wants all this cheap labour? You know, none of the interests that are working in that list.
Well, who wanted the cheap labour before we joined the European Union? We've had blacks flooding into this country from 1948, long before 1972 or 3 when we joined the EU.
I've got news for you. There were Pakistanis coming in before the war.
You know, well, wants cheap labour?
Bosses want cheap labour.
British bosses as well, not just Europeans.
Yeah, I agree with you. This is the problem. You've got to find a way of making a supranational body respect the interests of peoples.
I do want to defend point number two with the R&D issue.
R&D.
Yes, it's 3% EU GDP to be invested in R&D. I think this actually leads to economic growth in the sense that I suppose the R&D would go to development of new technologies, okay. Cutting edge things, allegedly. Okay. Perhaps some of it would go to the industry, kind of the military sector of that industry. Maybe they would get some of that too. But I think these things create engines of growth.
It would particularly benefit this country because we've got a huge pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, yes.
Which is massively into R&D.
Yeah, but it pays for itself. It can pay for its own R&D. Why do you have to have some supranational body laying down what national governments or itself, if it ever comes to that, will invest out of taxes? You know, no. The way that these things happen, you look at Apple. You know, it's just the most technologically stimulated company in the world. That hasn't done that because government came in and said, "Hi guys, let's invent this." It comes out of the ambitions and genius of individuals.
Are you suggesting that the massive computer companies don't get enormous tax breaks all around the world?
They may get enormous tax breaks, but what I'm saying is that they do not develop their products because they're instructed to from some sort of, you know, central bureau of development, central services.
I think you've got a problem with the government.
Do have a bit of a problem with government. They are not reflecting the will of the people.
Often they are already developing things, but I think there is such a thing as kind of like, I don't know, striking a spark or priming your industry to keep up with other ones. For instance, if you look at South Korea, Samsung, for example, they get total preferential treatment, I think, from the South Korean government. Mm. So how do you compete against things like Samsung or against essentially any Chinese or Japanese company when they're essentially getting the gravy train of money, and then if you guys don't replicate it on your side, then what happens?
Okay, well, there is a peculiarity in the European psyche, which is that we produced a lot of stupid people allied to a lot of extremely creative people, and that's one of the glories of our kind. And it is not replicated in any other race of man. It is not replicated among Jews. It is not replicated amongst East Asians. All of these peoples have their own marvelous talents. And that, but this one is very much us. We do produce outliers at both ends of the spectrum. And the state of European creativity, aesthetics, this tremendously rich nature of European intellectual life and of the... of course, the science and technology. All of this comes from the top-end outliers. Now, that won't go away. What you need to do, if you want to compete with everybody else in the world, is you just allow these people the freedom to do what they can do. We're not in the same situation technologically as we were 20, 30, 40 years ago now. I mean, a lot of the technology that is easy to get at, the low-hanging fruit, has been picked, and we're in a game now where perhaps from a sort of Chinese perspective, massive numbers, you know, of people, of researchers, massive efforts thrown at something is the way to make small incremental advances. But the vast breakthroughs, the fruits of vision and of strange, weird calculations that come out of nowhere when something, you know, some synapses connect. That is a peculiarly European talent, and we need to be true to our own nature and true to our ability and to trust in it as a race and to grant ourselves the capacity to live by our own genius. That's what we have to do. You know, falling back on taking money into central government and trying to get to invest it some way or other is a pretty poor substitute, I suggest.
Bill, I need to ask you. You have these experience with unions and union organization.
No, I think you're misunderstanding. I was a member of union movement, but that's not the British union movement.
Mosley's
post-war policy, which he brought out in 1948, was for Europe. He called it Europe a Nation, Europe to unite. This was a long time before the rest of the world called on this philosophy.
When would that have been, date-wise, Bill?
1948.
And
just
when,
after the war, yeah.
Right, and when was the European Union being mooted? Must have been
in the 50s, yeah. In the 50s,
right.
Yeah.
Right, so he was a few years in advance of it then.
Yeah, I mean, no, it wasn't an original idea. These ideas have been kicking around for a long time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But he was the first British politician that I know of to advocate it.
Hmm. Right, fair enough. Let's go to the other area of concern, which I did mention at the beginning, but we got sidetracked, which is the state of a politics of dissent, which I call nationalism. I know that you have problems with that word, but anyway, let's generalize it and call it dissent. We've got a number of parties which still exist, but only just. They're mostly on life support. The exception is UKIP. You're hostile to UKIP.
You don't like UKIP very much, no.
Reasons?
Well, it's just a different attitude.
I mean, I know they're anti-European, but they are offering an opportunity to dissent from the establishment, which in itself is useful.
They're a strange party, aren't they? They've got this problem with immigration. They just don't like Poles. Nigel Farage says he feels uncomfortable with people speaking Polish around him. But he presumably doesn't feel uncomfortable about Pakistanis or Indians speaking
their
language.
But he hasn't got the courage to say so.
Ah, well, there you go. I thought that people from the jolly old Commonwealth were welcome with UKIP.
I think that the situation is...
His party's full of blacks and Indians.
Yes,
actually, that's a good point. That's a good point. If he's in favour of Commonwealth migration, that covers an awful lot of countries that traditionally people would not expect to be inviting into the European Union.
Yeah, well, he always says, you know, that potentially half a billion Europeans have got the right to come here. under the Free Movement of Labour. But he doesn't mention that 3 billion Commonwealth citizens have got the right to come here.
And indeed. Even if you just take the northern side of South America and the Caribbean, for example, Nigel Farage, when he makes these statements, he's essentially saying that everyone from that entire region of the world can go to the United Kingdom.
What they're doing is the art of the possible. The truth is, it's what they have to do. And it is working, Bill. It's actually functioning. They got 3.8 million votes. That's something, you know. It is working. They didn't get 3.8 million votes because people think that there's somehow an argument that you can make for excluding Poles, but not excluding all of these people from the Commonwealth and from the rest of the world. They vote for them because they just want an alternative to this politics of sameness.
They voted for Ron Paul, and it's a red herring.
It is, but I don't think we can afford to write them off and just say, oh no, they're no good for this reason, for that reason. Yes, they're full of inconsistencies, but we really need some kind of dissent that people can rally around. And if their opinions today don't necessarily gel, or if their supporters' opinions aren't all of a kind, that's because we live in this extremely difficult political environment when so little can be said and when great truths cannot be spoken.
Isn't the argument against them that they are diverting attention from energies from the real the genuine nationalists? More thing I want to say is like, ideally native Britain should be like 97%, and you have like 2 or 3% foreigners. There should be no foreigners from non-European continents, or as close to nothing as possible. I'm talking about ideally. Wait a minute. I'm almost finished. When you're talking about that 2 or 3%, if a fraction of that, I mean like 0.5% is Polish, I don't think that that's the end of the world. Or 0.5% is German. Or I'm talking about a very small. I mean, I wouldn't mind 0.5% of English in Poland. I wouldn't want as many English in Poland as there are Polish in England. I can object to that. But when you're saying that they're the same as blacks, I think that's a bit heavy-handed in assertion.
I want to mention
the issue of South Asia, Southeast Asia, and parts of South America, because I feel like this argument might run into a problem where you've got what I call the patriotism problem. Where someone will say, oh, there should be no one inside the United Kingdom except people who are British, and so on and so forth. And then someone else might respond, perhaps accurately, and say, what about all of the persons who were brought here because of the fact that they were employed in hoc, or essentially working for British military interests at some point in history, and were essentially brought here for that purpose? So for instance, I'll name, for example, the Gurkhas, obviously. Many of the people who are classified as martial races within Northeast India and Northwest India, so they would be referred to as the Sepoys at that particular time. Some people in Southeast Asia that were brought in for that purpose, like Tibeto-Burmans and so on and so forth. And so those people would have had ancestors who fought for the British Empire, or fought on the side of the British Empire, or may have helped administer colonies in Africa on behalf of the British Empire as a kind of intermediary. For instance, many of the people from Uganda who are not African, but in fact Asian, are also basically people who are employed by Britain to act as part of the administrative framework. Same issue with parts of the Caribbean and South America as well. So they might be here, and then you say to them, you know, get the hell out, for example, they will look back at you and say, why? You see what I mean?
People can do whatever it decides about its own future. That's something which it can do. Those who find themselves on the wrong end of those decisions don't have control of their own destinies in general. That's a fact of ethnic life. The clearest case of that, which you've mentioned empire, one of the greatest sins of British Empire was moving around Asians, because there's a class of competent Asians amongst the Brahmin and Kshatriya castes, who were able to act as administrators all over the empire. Now, if you go to Fiji, you see that there is a huge Indian presence in Fiji.
Yes, it's true.
And, you know, one can only feel compassionate for the Fijians. They didn't ask for this. The Fijians have rights on the land. The Indians don't.
But I mean, furthermore, the Fijians themselves and many of the Pacific Islanders were also asked to essentially work for the United Kingdom, which is why many of them were in the SAS. And so that's another one where you're going to have a slight problem negotiating this, because of the fact that if you might be stripping many people out of your military in the process of doing this, if someone were to actually enact these policies.
All I would say is that if the problem is small, then it probably can be dealt with under gene flow regulations. It can be viewed as gene flow, which classically is from neighbouring territories, or perhaps through port cities and capital cities. So you do get that phenomenon, and it's in nature, it's part of the human existence. If the problem is large, then it has to be dealt with, and hard decisions have to be taken. There is no moral cause on the land greater than the natural interests, the life interests of the people of the land. That is the ultimate interest on that land. And there is no alternative or competing interest from any other ethnic source, which happens to be present there, which has a great... I'm being an objectivist here. I know Daniel won't like that, but it has
That's not objectivist. That's not in the sense that I'm in.
This is a question of ethics. So, I think in those very hard circumstances where there are long-standing communities which are in conflict and which will remain in conflict, that has to be resolved for keeps in favour of the native people, providing they have not fought for their land and lost it. The other moral issue of this is that, you know, if a people doesn't consent to its own colonisation, then the only basis on which that colonisation is legitimised is when there is a battle, a war, has happened in America with the armed men on horseback fought each other, and victory is eventually attained by the colonizers, and at that moment the land passes to the colonizers. So if that hasn't happened, then those who are colonizing, if there's no consent, then those who are colonizing will have to end the colonization and find another way forward.
Yes, what I would say is that the tension which is being described, or the opposition which is being described, I wouldn't describe it as necessarily an opposition. Many of these people who we're talking about here, at least when we're talking about Asian population groups, we're talking about people who are, of course, mostly loyal to the United Kingdom.
Yeah, but loyalty is
with the exception, of course, of obviously radical Pakistani Muslims who have been marauding.
It makes no difference what the loyalty is. What people claim, I don't. That's not important. That's only just a surface thing. Oh no, look at me! I am very loyal. I drink tea and with my picture of the Queen. You know, no, sorry, I'm not buying that. That's not the game. We're talking about serious stuff. You know, we're talking about the destiny of peoples. This can't get more serious than that.
Yeah, I don't mean superficially loyal, of course. I mean, like, you know, sort of willing to die on the end of the sword.
Same difference to me. You know, in the end, what matters is genetic interests. It is that which is the final arbiter of human destiny.
It seems, GW, that can be... There's a way to calculate that. You say these many immigrants amongst the British can conceivably be managed. And at the same time, this kind of population has got to be... We have to make sure that it's replicated through whatever means, sacrament or just a serious consideration of what it takes to maintain a certain essence of the native British population. So I think there can be calculations that rationally outline what can be handled, and it's probably best that this be consciously made so that it's understood, so that conflict doesn't emerge because people don't know what's at stake.
Let's ask Bill what he would like to see.
Just before he does that, I thought it was very normal that if you have a very large kind of military imperial dimension sized entity, that it would have subalterns who are not necessarily of the same majority ethnic group. I mean, for as long as human history has been going on, there have always been subalterns who are not part of the group, but nevertheless serve it.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean...
For example, when you look at that that story in Iraq, Iraq, where they talked about that Gurkha who killed 30 jihadists with the broken-off table leg, for example. I don't think anyone in Britain would say, you know, this person has not served British EGI. Killing 30 jihadists with a table leg is definitely serving British EGI, I would think.
I have to tell you that, you know, there are probably in Nepal 500,000 fine young men who can each be trained in martial arts to deliver death with a table leg.
Definitely.
And I hope I don't meet any of them soon, because they may have political disagreement with me. But the fact remains that, you know, they are not us. And in the end, because this has become existential now, this is about our survival. It's not about being kind to people. It's not about being generous-hearted and tolerant and warm and liberal. Oh, look at my fastidious liberal sensibility. It's not about that. It is about the survival of our people. It's got to that. The demographics is established, situation is structural, and we really have to now think of our own existence. And this is where it's at now, today, tomorrow. You know, this thing is going to move on. It's going to mix up all the peoples of the world. It's an engine of ethnic destruction. It's called globalism.
It has to be stopped.
It has to be stopped here.
I would say this. Many Asians myself included, do indeed agree with you on this. So you would not try to obstruct your attempt to fight out this position, and we would be very happy to assist. So it's not a case that there's an antagonism that would manifest. I don't think there would be if it's laid out in a particular way that is not aimed at doing particular damage in that direction. I think most Asian people would be happy to go along with that.
Well, sure, it would be reciprocated. The point is that from a Solterian perspective, since we're talking about him, we are talking about the universal right of peoples to destine in their own cause. That has to be the fundamental universal right. It can't be any higher principle in human existence. So, you know, that's why nationalists, I call myself a nationalist, Bill, are the most moral of all political actors.
But there seems to be a way to negotiate this. Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to know, Bill, from the racial perspective, what you would like to see done, what your ideal solution would be at this point. Not necessarily, you know, the art of the possible stuff, but what your ideal would be.
Yeah. I think it's all a question of numbers. You know, small numbers of non-Europeans we can accommodate. It's not an ideal situation.
Name
but,
a small number. I mean, what sort of percentage of our population?
Well,
Quarter of a percent,
I mean, at the moment, they're talking about Afghan interpreters wanting to come here because they're a danger in their own country. You know, ones that work for the British Army. I can see some point in letting them in, maybe. Mm-hmm. But millions and millions of particularly African blacks, we don't need.
And what solution?
We absolutely don't need. We must think of some way of restoring them to their own country. And the only way that I can think is, as I said, through some more powerful institution than just the United Kingdom.
I'd be one to cooperate with that. I volunteer Poland's help.
Also, I like this mention you've made of Afghan interpreters, because I wanted to raise that earlier as well. That basically sometimes you have to have this small percentage of people who are not from your ethnic group, because of the fact that the utility of having them on your side is because only they can swim in certain environments. Mm. So, for example, particularly in the intelligence services as well, you would need to have, in some context, some South Asian community to reach into to recruit people that can swim in that territory to find out information for you, because you cannot send literally a white spy looking like James Bond into the middle of Bangladesh, for example.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to get anywhere if you do that.
Okay. Bill, just to put some numbers on things, what sort of percentage of non-native do you think is bearable in the long term?
Oh, I don't know exactly, but it would be low, you know.
Low, right.
Yeah, maybe up to 5%, something like that. Yeah. Certainly not what we've got at the moment.
No.
What's
now,
the percent
when it
now?
Comes to
about 22.
Going back to demographics, you know, the all European populations are declining or ceasing to reproduce at an acceptable rate.
Yes.
So we are going to need, unless our economy shrinks, unless we allow our economy to shrink, we're going to need immigrants. So we've just got to make our mind up where we get these immigrants from.
Well, now, we can always bring back our own people from, you know, the other side of the world.
Well, that's not going to happen. What? Bring back the Australians and the Canadians. That's not going to happen.
What? For free housing?
No, it just wouldn't happen. This is a fantastic idea.
No. First of all, the economy is not the reason we're alive. The economy is our servant, not the other way around. The principle has to be clear. We do not exist to serve businesses. If businesses
that's a fine sentiment. But what happens when you go to hospital and there's nobody there to look after you because we're just short of people? What do you do then?
What do you do if you can't get a bus because we haven't got any bus drivers?
You put
hospital staff on visas and you train your own people. How do you think we always managed? You're thinking short term.
We had a smaller economy than we've got now.
Yeah, but we still the same number of people. How many? The economy you have is the economy you make for your own people. You don't make a people of some sort, size, shape, description, colour.
Just to give an example, my sister lives in Taunton in Somerset.
Lucky girl.
Now, they never used to have a bus service there years ago. You had to get cabs all the time. Now they've got quite a good bus service. And it is entirely 100% Polish. Now they just couldn't get any. There's unemployment in the West Country, but they could not get anybody to drive buses.
You have to maintain a proper perspective in these matters. Economics is very important, but it isn't as important as life. And we have to care for our life first. The economy, we can fit after. We're a very capable people. I mean, you know,
we're very capable people.
We can do everything we need. We just have to have a little bit of confidence. Hell, you know, we don't need the confidence the Victorians had. They had so much confidence they conquered the world. We don't need that. All we need is enough self-belief just to say we could manage our own affairs and to do it. We don't need any more than that. We're very capable of it. Let's have some trust.
Okay, so if our population is declining and we don't bring in assimilable immigrants,
we turn the decline
Europeans.
Around. We turn the decline around. How do you turn the decline around? You start to do certain things which are supportive of marriage and long-term relationships, and you start to do certain things which are supportive of women in the home, and you also change
the culture war.
They've
tried awful hard in Russia, They've tried awful hard in Russia for the last
20 years. You change the culture war. They created poverty in Russia. You change the culture war, and you change the basis of economics, and you make the thing function. That's what you do. You trust your own ingenuity and genius to resolve these matters. We do not have to have a negative fertility. It's not some force of nature. We're not some kind of ancient, decrepit organism that's dying because it has no vitality. We've got vitality, but we're living in an age that is sapping us. It is the nature of the age we're living. It's the neoliberalism, economism, globalism.
It might be possible to change the culture, but it's going to take an awful long time.
Oh, sure. So it's going to take
great effort. Yeah.
10 years. But I mean, you know, during that time, people that you need in order to help with the transition, you put on visas. That's all you
do. This is my proposition that there are, for instance, with the European Union, there are good arguments for and against. You can make an argument either way, an economic argument or whatever. I'm interested in a political solution.
Yeah.
I want Europe to unite because I want the white racists to stand together, and I see this as the start of it. I admit it is a totally capitalist, globalist institution, but that's a matter of internal reform.
That's where we're starting.
Yeah. I can't see any advantage in the United Kingdom breaking away from the single market. And it certainly wouldn't do anything to advance nationalism in this country. It would not restore our sovereignty because we would still belong to all the international bodies that control trade and commerce.
No, but, you know, the all of these things hang together. I mean, you know, when you begin the process of changing the polity away from liberalism, you said liberalism, we live in a liberal age. We live in a liberal thought world.
Yeah, and, but, you know, and 20 and years ago, things, everybody smoked, didn't they?
Exactly. The beauty of it is that if you can begin the process, if you can set foot on it somewhere, you're no longer working against history. You're working with it. And that's the stage that we have to get to.
Well, I can't argue with that, yeah. And our task must be one of education and persuasion.
Yes, there is an educational task. My friend Soren Renner, who's connected to our website, Soren has got this phrase, which I don't know where he dug it up from, but it's the war of discourse. We're fighting a war of discourse. I think it comes from Clausewitz. I'm not totally sure, but anyway, the war of ideas or hearts and minds, however you want to put it, but his term I think is the best. That really is the one that people like you and I are engaged in on a daily basis.
Therefore worries me that you've got so much faith in democracy and what you call the will of the people. Have the people got any idea what they want? Somebody like the media tells them what they want. At the moment, I want thousands of Syrian refugees because I feel sorry for the little boy that washed up on the beach.
Before we came on.
Yes. I'm wondering sometimes if there can be almost too much of an appeal to democracy.
No.
I think, can it go too much in the other direction?
No, because democracy isn't the end value. The end value is the nature of the people itself. That, you know, in an emergent sense, it is the nature of the people which forms the polity, and it is the nature of the polity which informs the nature of democracy that's practiced in it. So democracy is not the first rung on the ladder. Everything has to emerge from the nature of the people themselves. And nationalism of an existential kind must concern itself with freeing that nature to speak and live and love and act in its own cause and out of itself. That's really the fundamentally simple and beautiful idea which is at the heart of nationalist thought. And you know, everything else follows from that.
What do you see as the main interest groups in society that should be most in charge, as in who is most in the driver's seat?
First of all, there's going to be elites. There's going to be elites in any society. You know, Bill's been involved in nationalism, and he's named some people who were, in terms of their political genius in their age, to arise as they did in such a uncompromising way and in such difficult circumstances politically. That those men probably belong to the natural elites. In an ethno-nationalist polity, in a naturalistic and an ethno-nationalist polity, founded on the natural interest of the people in their own life and continuity, fundamentally. The elites would be those who are most loyal and visionary in their understanding of what those interests are and capable in their execution and administration of those interests. That's who they would be.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of how the power structure would work, those people you just described, their word would be law, would it not?
No, they would be elected, or they would stand for election And if they were successful, then they would go to a chamber which would make law, yes. But the nature of the polity is such that they are not imposing out of themselves and their own interests, but they are interpreting politically the interests which are redolent in the entire system and which inform it.
I agree with you. There's probably, in all societies, only about 10% of people who know what's going on.
Yes, even less than that, maybe.
Less. So, yeah, there will always be elites under any system, and I don't see that changing radically. What I would like to see change is the power and the influence of the huge corporations, not just the banks, the oil companies, and all the rest of it. Yeah. They're so powerful that they're bigger than states.
Bigger than states. Yes.
They have a will of their own.
But do they have that kind of power in a different system founded on different principles? And what would happen to that kind of power? Would it be able to survive? It did survive in National Socialism.
It has to be controlled. Do you remember what happened when the Gulf disaster happened in the Gulf of Mexico with BP rig? Yeah. And Obama said at the time, if necessary, he'll shut BP down. Well, of course, that was a stupid statement. BP is almost as powerful as the United States in the world. He had no chance of shutting them down.
Exactly.
He had very little chance of getting his money.
They did pretty well, though. It was a good shakedown.
Well, yeah, it's nothing to BP.
Nah, well, maybe not.
Yeah, they seem to have bounced back from it relatively quickly.
Yeah, I'm sure
they are hugely powerful. These big international corporations are massively powerful, and they need to be controlled. Mm. I don't want to wipe them out or break them up. It can't be done, but they can be controlled.
So we're talking really about breaking the power they hold over politics.
Yeah, the international banks, the international oil companies, the big corporations need to be controlled. And I believe that we are getting nearer to it than we have been in the past already.
Was Oswald Mosley the closest that you've known to someone who could represent the kind of power elite that you'd like to see?
Yeah, I admire Mosley, but there are talented men in every generation and in every country, and they will come forward.
But wasn't he a National Socialist or an admirer of National Socialism? Or
yeah.
What? So that seemed to be a kind of socialist thing, and unions seemed to be a part of that. Wouldn't that be one way to take on this corporate hegemony?
Well, it had the chance.
Syndicalism?
And it didn't, did it? I mean, National Socialism
they didn't do it right.
The Nazi Revolution only lasted a year, didn't it? 1934,
especially after the night of the long knives, that was the end of that, right?
Yeah, stresses.
I mean, all these ideas about workers' control of industry went out the window when I was fighting the war. And all these huge corporations that Hitler had talked about controlling were not controlled. Krupps and Siemens and all the rest of it.
He made deals with them.
Provided them with labour.
Yeah. That's why it doesn't do, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, sort of extreme positions are all very well, but we've got to deal with the realities of the world.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about Hitler. I'm talking about, some aspects from the Strassers and so on, and whatever. I mean, surely Oswald Mosley had some things right. You must think so.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. He believed in syndicalism. He believed in workers' partnership. But
that seems to be what we're arriving at here too. Is this would be a means to deal with the plutocrats and the corporations and these sort of neoliberal internationalists.
And by deal with, I assume you mean place into check or place into balance and not break up completely. Yes.
Hmm. Okay.
Yes. I can't see any advantage
in dismantling the big oil companies. They know what they're doing. They're very good at extracting oil and distributing it.
Exactly.
I would just like to make sure that they don't control whole governments and whole continents with their political power.
Which they do. We've got the Gulf War.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Yeah.
Mm. There are also ways, I think, well, you can tell me whether you agree or not, Bill. There are ways where you can actually have your interests aligned with those of oil companies at certain times as well. For example, there's the the threat in northern Iraq, which is where many of these migrants are presently coming from, of course, and where ISIL is manifesting, and who has the largest oil interests in that area at the moment. That would be ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil, yeah, also the same company which supplies the entire Royal Air Force with much of its aviation fuel. So you can see how this is actually a circular link occurring. Yeah. So you can actually satisfy your interests in some cases by working alongside these companies, because they are beholden to the state in some ways as well.
Yeah, so I'm sure you're right. The thing that strikes me, people are not quite as clever as they think they are. And we can go along with big corporations because we think it's in our national interest. But our experience in the Middle East suggests to me that we should mind our own business, because we don't really know what we're doing. Especially America doesn't know what it's doing. We always follow America.
The British have been in Iraq before. I think we overran Iraq in 4 days in the 1930s, didn't we?
We had 100,000 men there, mostly Indians.
Yeah.
Mm, yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you know what you're doing, then you can do all sorts of things. But as soon as you disengage and you cease to operate as a global player, then you're involved in protecting your interests through unions with other nations or with other players. And in so much as that's the case, then your ideological position is perfectly logical. Bill, I'm really glad to have met you. I do read European Outlook. I want you to know that your words are not wasted. And I enjoy it, and don't stop sending it. And the day that it stops rattling into my inbox, I shall start worrying about you. You know, have they finally come and knocked on the door and taken you away? Will I be next? So, Bill, thank you very much indeed, and keep in touch. All the best to you.
Yes, it's been a privilege.
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Very kind. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's all right. Bye-bye.